Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Hi, everyone. John, thank you for the invite. My name is Vlad Kazaku. During the day, I'm the regional director of investments for Assure Syndicates, a group of about 700 angel investors and family offices. And during the night, I'm the co-founder and CEO of Floaty Technologies, building data infrastructure for the venture capital space.
Vlad, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy podcast. It's always exciting to interview folks, you know, here in South Florida. So I'm excited about this conversation that we have planned. Before we do that and talk about all the great things you're currently building, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Sure thing. I'd say the brief intro goes as follows. You know, born and raised in Bucharest, Romania, in Eastern Europe, came to the United States for a college at the University of Rochester. Actually ran a startup while I was in college in the edtech space, got an acquisition offer, turned that down. One of the big regrets of my life so far that prompted me to do a lot of research into how can we best support early stage entrepreneurs. Hence why a couple of years later, I got an offer to publish a book on the topic, which got published in about 2019. Being then moved into the venture capital space as an investor, FFVC in New York, then grad school at UT Austin at McCombs, where I was also an investor with View Venture Partners out of SF. And after business school, moved to Miami, Florida for my current role, where I'm the regional director of investments for Assure Syndicates.
Oh, that's super exciting. Very, very diverse career you had so far. You've mentioned you've dabbed into angel investments and got introduced to, you know, venture in general while in business school. Tell us a little bit more about that process, or how did you come about just overall, you know, as a fellow entrepreneur myself, I've, you know, dealt with my share of VCs and angel investors and gone through multiple fundraising rounds. So it's definitely a journey. And for me, the natural progression was also taking that experience and now helping the kind of the founders alike to learn from some of the mistakes that I've made, so making further introductions and things as such. Share a little bit more from your perspective. How did you get into the whole world of investing?
Sure thing. So actually the pathway into investing started with that book, right? By interviewing a lot of folks in startup studios, accelerators and incubators, I got very well connected to call it the acceleration and support infrastructure of entrepreneurs, which naturally led to a lot of conversations with investors. And my natural question there was, all right, how can I provide value to those people? How can I connect the dots that other people are not connected? So started sourcing, you know, for friends and connections, which led to, you know, the offer to join, you know, FF Venture Capital for that time. And also being able to be well connected with other angel investors and family offices, which I started, you know, co-investing alongside. So most of my angel checks happened because I was trying to connect the dots between investors and founders and helping them. And then it made sense for me to also put some money into those opportunities. And then that led me to be a minor LP into a fund of a friend, which also got exposure to a lot of other deals. And obviously the way I progressed at View Venture Partners and now at Assure Syndicates, I get much more exposure to founders in their business. So this time I invested, I think it was 37 or 38 angel checks so far. So not a very big portfolio, and it's, you know, I would say well diversified so far, but it all came the more access I got to those deals.
Well, it's definitely impressive. Between 30 and 40 portfolio companies, that's the size of a typical, you know, fund one of any venture capital firm. That's definitely, you know, an understatement there.
Definitely number of deals, not the number of dollars. I'll say that.
Absolutely. So you've been in South Florida ecosystem for a little bit right now. What different trends, and, you know, you probably do a lot of research in this particular space, and more specifically in South Florida, probably we've seen a great growth in the past couple of years in terms of startup ecosystem, the fundraising opportunities and things like that. What are you seeing in South Florida these days, and what are you mostly excited about?
For sure. And I think I have a better insight on what I'm seeing in the venture ecosystem in South Florida from the investor perspective rather than from the startup ecosystem perspective. Yeah. because my move to South Florida was primarily driven by us having a lot of LPs and clients in South Florida. And what I'm seeing is that a lot of family offices and investors who've primarily made their money in real estate and industrials are actually starting to participate in the venture ecosystem as angel investors and making, you know, technology investments from pre-seed all the way to Series B and growth stage, which is very similar to what you would see in Silicon Valley, you know, 20, 25 years ago, which I think was a huge driver of the entrepreneurial ecosystem there. So I'm very, very excited about the participation of business folks and especially traditional business folks into this new wave of startups, because that is helping them not only get capital faster, but also allows them to get plugged in to people who've built sustainable businesses. So what I'm seeing right now in South Florida is actually the beginning of a shift in trends from building, you know, small businesses and non-traditional tech companies to building startups and the participation of the larger business ecosystem in that growth.
Right, absolutely. No, that's definitely exciting, especially with the growth in venture space here in South Florida. We, you know, starting with the mayor and all of the venture funds that actually have relocated here, it's definitely exciting times to be an entrepreneur, to be a founder, especially here in South Florida.
Exactly. So
that definitely relates on so many levels. Tell us a little bit more about your investment thesis, or maybe how do you go about essentially your criteria for evaluating founders that you personally get very excited about. What are some of the things that you observe or you pay attention to during the initial meetings with the founders that you like to invest in? Tell us a little bit more about that process.
Sure thing. And I'll give the perspective of what we do at Assure Syndicate, since that's where I'm deploying most of my capital, not the angel investment. That's much more opportunistic and founder-driven and opportunity-driven. But at Assure Syndicate, we have two primary theses in terms of industry and stage. We are looking at companies innovating in the commerce stack. So everything from production tech, logistics, supplies, e-commerce infrastructure, as well as brands and collect alternative data and ad tech. And the second thesis is around B2B enterprise enablement. So applications of AI and machine learning to processes and optimizations of processes across enterprises and small and medium-sized businesses. So across those two, we are investing pre-seed to Series B. Small checks would not lead. And what we're looking for in founders is a very clear business model. That is kind of our bread and butter. We go very deep into understanding the pricing structure and the way people are overall creating their businesses, how they're extracting value from their processes, and how are they creating moats based in their business models and their data models. So we may be a little bit more technical on the finance and technology side there than the average investor, because we want to make sure the founder spent enough time understanding, can this be a scalable business? Do I have the right margins? Can this, you know, at scale be profitable? Where a lot of, I would say, investors, you know, don't pay attention to it and say, well, you know, as long as it grows for the next couple of years, I'm good with that. We're not. We're looking to be very long-term partners, and we prefer people who have a long-term vision of their business.
You interact with founders and entrepreneurs probably on a daily basis, and most likely sit on boards of some of the startups or your portfolio companies even. In the current markets, especially in the last couple of years, talent acquisition or, you know, just overall hiring, especially in technology space, has been, you know, just extremely competitive on the global scale.
For sure.
What are some of the strategies that you deploy to help maybe some of your portfolio companies succeed in that space when it comes to attracting the top talent and furthermore retaining that?
For sure. And I'll say, I'll start with this, you know, hiring is tough, right? Like this is kind of the biggest issue that we're seeing with our portfolio companies is understanding how to get technical talent at scale, the right people onboard them, retain them. And sadly, I would say it's very location dependent. Even nowadays, with COVID and remote work, because you do have very clear pipelines coming up, top research universities and other larger enterprises where people churn and want to, you know, explore new career changes, like moving to a startup or a smaller organization. So you see that primarily even in, you know, New York, SF, LA, Seattle, Austin, Nashville, and not as much yet in cities like Miami, for example, where we are right now. But that's changing because you also see more enterprise activity here, but also more people be willing to relocate and to Miami. On the techniques we're helping folks with, There's actually two things we do. One is obviously engaging our network, and the benefit of being an angel syndicate, which is very, very different than running a fund, is that we have 700 people in our network that are actively participating in our opportunities. They are executives, Fortune 500 companies, C-levels of different organizations, VPs of, not-for-profits or other community organizations. And those are folks who are really the boots on the ground across the whole, North America, primarily US and Canada. And they are a fantastic sourcing engine for our startups. The second part is helping the founder understand their vision and messaging on hiring. And that is more a personal one-on-one conversation and coaching to make sure that they've clearly identified what makes them unique and showcase some of our investment thesis and why we invested on why other people should join that company, right? It's a very similar decision, why you would invest, in our case, money, but not other people time. So helping the founders craft that messaging that we've already crafted for our angels is really important.
Yeah, you bring up a very good point in terms of ability to sell that vision and the overall mission that, your startup is all about, because at the early stages, especially, it becomes, probably one of the very few attributes or assets that you can actually sell when it comes to attracting the top talent. So that definitely makes a perfect sense. When it comes to just overall concept of a value add investor, there's a lot of content out there. There's a lot of different, specializations that VCs operate in. Some are generalized, some, in more niche spaces where they are able to provide maybe a little bit more value, beyond capital. Share your thoughts overall on just a value add investor. What are some of the things you've seen in the market, and what is that concept even, does that even exist?
Sure thing. I'll give the short answer, and the long answer is that is actually the core thesis of the book that I published. It's called When They Win, You Win: A More Human Approach to Supporting Entrepreneurship, which is all about the idea of value add outside of capital and how that helps you win deals and get more returns out of your investments. But my biggest point and insight here is that you really must create a value add that makes sense to you as an investor. Mm-hmm. You cannot say your value add and try to do everything, because there's a matter of bandwidth of time and energy and mental energy that you can spend on helping people, and also the types of things you're just naturally good at. And in order, I think it's first step, first reflection, right, on understanding what you're really good at and where you can provide value to those people. And second is branding, right? Making sure people understand that this is, what you're known for, that if they go to John or if they go to Vlad, they'll be able to get some capital as well as help with this. And in our case, with the short syndicates, the answer is very simple. We just have our very wide network of angel investors, and our whole thesis is bringing people on board who could be advisors, who could be board members, who could be channel partners, who could be clients. So people know that when they're engaging with us in those two verticals, the commerce tech and the enterprise, so not as much on the consumer, we're able to give them contracts. We're able to give them advisors and people who move the needle. We're organizing calls with C-levels and VPs and SVPs at companies that they're trying to target. And we bring them all in one room because we have a pre-existing relationship with them, because that's our model. For a venture fund, especially a smaller fund, that may not work, but they may have incredible experience in branding, marketing, fundraising, finance, accounting, operations, whatever it is, from the previous life of the GPs before they started the fund. And funds who are very, very targeted and are able to clearly communicate through their branding are the ones where I see founders gravitate to for that particular value add. Otherwise, capital, it is a commodity, and it's very hard to compete if you don't have a clear message of how you help founders. And that's mandatory in today's ecosystem. People are not looking just for capital. They're looking for capital and very clear help on your end.
Absolutely. Especially in the past couple of years, we've seen capital just being highly commoditized, where it's not so much of a competitive edge that investors can leverage when it comes to winning extremely competitive deals. So that makes perfect sense. What are you talking about?
Yeah. And one thing that I would add there is the rise of the platform, right? We've seen this over the past, I would say 4 or 5 years, so many director of platforms, head of platforms, all of that is just portfolio support, right? Is the idea of we're going to get a person whose sole role is to do value add, who make connections, who help people, who run events. And that is a very clear testament of this is needed. And it's helpful to the founders. So it helps everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. So you bring up a good point, and I want to double click on that a little bit further in terms of emergence of new roles or new opportunities that do come about as the market, you know, specific market needs. When it comes to emerging technologies or maybe emerging markets, in terms of the trends that you personally very excited about when it comes to investment opportunities, what are you researching these days? What are you personally very excited about?
Sure. So for the risk of sounding very corny and mainstream today, I'll have to give the honest answer right now, which is crypto, right? Is the application of blockchain across most of our existing business models and business operations. I think that's a very fascinating technological revolution we're seeing. It's still very, very early, and understanding the true implications of smart contracts, NFTs, crypto coins into current and existing business processes, I would say it's mandatory for us to be able to understand what's going to happen in the next 10, 15, 20 years of our world, because I believe that that's not going away. I believe that's staying with us, and we just need to understand how to embrace and make the most out of that technology. And all the jazz and fuss and call it the alternative coins and the ups and downs and the pumps are just very similar to what was happening in the late 90s, early 2000s with the dot-com bubble. So that will shall pass, but we still have internet, we still have mobile phones, we still have all the connectivity out there. So that's the same thesis that I have on this. And we're actively researching and understanding how can we participate in the upside and how can we discern what companies truly build something for the long term and what companies are going to burst in the next couple of years.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely resonates on so many levels. And I don't view that as an obligatory answer at all, because there's just, emergence in terms of opportunities. And where this overall as an industry shifting towards to, it definitely makes perfect sense. We've briefly touched upon talent acquisition, and interviewing is a space that's, at least for me, it's interesting, but at the same time, very challenging. I've been on different sides of the equation of, being the candidate, being the hiring manager. And it's overall concept of, what are the weaknesses that we can tolerate in that particular candidate versus what are the strengths that are missing on our team, and can that particular candidate fill that void? What are your thoughts overall on interviewing, and what are some of the recommendations that you provide perhaps to your maybe portfolio company founders or any other entrepreneurs that you work with? Just curious to get your thoughts on improving that space of candidate experience during the interview.
Sure. And I'll disclaim that I'm not an expert in hiring and take everything that I'm saying with a grain of salt, because I'm taking a very third party view on this. But where I see a lot of founders succeeding in hiring is through this idea of, test driving or project based hiring, especially on the software side, because there are people who are interviewing fantastically well and not do a great job. And there are people who are terrible interviewing and do a fantastic job. And I'm always advising folks, if they're in the later stages of interviewing with candidates, give them something to do and see if they're able to move the needle for your organization, because it's a very long-term commitment and you're going to spend a lot of time, energy, effort, money into accelerating and onboarding this person. And only to find out that 6 months later, they're just not underperforming. That's not the risk you should be taking when your head is in hiring, building product, fundraising, building partnerships and relationships, et cetera. You have very limited time as a founder of an early stage startup. So being able to get people as contractors in the beginning or through the interviewing and process to get them to complete certain tasks that you need, obviously not using them as free labor, but doing this constructively and productively, I think it's very important. But again, that's just my viewpoint, and it may not be accurate or applicable to all the startups we're talking to.
Yeah, absolutely. And to take that a little bit further, in terms of your personal interview style or the types of questions that you like to ask, whether you're hiring somebody for your own teams or whether you are evaluating a founder, give us a little bit of a glimpse into that process. What are the different questions that you personally like, and what do you look for in the responses when you hear them?
Sure thing. So like in our industry, I'll give the two brief answers. One of them on our team, we're actually going through the hiring process right now. So it's very timely, this question. One of the things for us is attention to detail. Like we must be very, very clear and intentional about the work that we're doing and make sure we're not missing anything, right? We're managing people's money. We can't afford to make mistakes. And for me, that's very important. And one of the tasks that I gave, folks anonymized two different, a convertible note and a term sheet, and ask people to say, I know there's a mistake in this, you have to go and find it, right? Because soon you're going to be faced with signing a term sheet, and you must be able to understand it and the convertible note to understand it, read it, and if there's any mistake, correct it in time. So that is our, you know, was one of our process of, you know, testing attention to detail. On the founder side, I want to really understand if the founders have a good grasp of their business, of what they're building, and they're very practical operators, not just, you know, long-term dreamers. So one of the questions that I always ask is, tell me, you know, why would someone not use your product? Tell me about your anti-customer. Tell me why someone would hate this. Tell me why you're not hiring and not trying to sell to these types of customers, to get a better understanding of, you know, the founder not saying, well, we're selling to everyone. This is the market for everything. That they're very targeted. They know their go-to-market. And if they're a little bit later on, let's call it a seed or a series A, post-product, maybe post-revenue, tell me your worst customer story. Tell me, understand why you failed to deliver value and what you learned from it, and how has that changed the course of your business? Because people who are able to be very introspective and understand why they shouldn't do all these other stuff and focus on this are the founders who are really excelling early stage, because you only have 24 hours. And unfortunately, a lot of founders that I'm speaking with are so overburnt and overwhelmed because the prioritization is just non-existent in their business. And I can't afford to, you know, invest in someone that is not able to manage their time properly and their mental energy properly.
Right, absolutely. There's one framework that comes to mind as you were giving all the great examples of that is, I'm sure you're familiar with that, the Sequoia way of running their board meetings, where they talk about the pre-parade and pre-mortem, where a conversation is all around what are some of the things that I am taking now, or some of the actions, or maybe even goals that I'm setting that will lead me to the point where if we're successful or we had failed, and we're looking back as a retrospective, you know, to avoid the coulda, woulda, shoulda, what are some of the things that we can think of now in terms of, you know, to get to that success? Or if we fail, what are some of the things that, as you were talking about, what are some of the things that I shouldn't do, or maybe anti-goals? So a lot of those things that make perfect sense. So that's great. Thank you for sharing that. In terms of your just overall advice, so maybe series of recommendations that you had received early in your career that you continuously revert back to, or maybe you give that similar advice to some of the entrepreneurs or maybe folks that you mentor, just share some thoughts around that perspective.
Sure. And I would say this is both something that came a little bit earlier in my career. And also, you know, my career hasn't been that long. I'm still relatively young and still building a reputation in the space. So I'm going to give the caveat of that. But something that's been a recurring theme is this idea of relationship building, but true relationship building, not just the idea of networking. And I think this comes from, you know, what you may call an old style of doing business, an old school of doing business where everything was relationship-based, but it still is, especially in this industry. And I think very few folks really take this and make it an art, right? This idea of, you know, client management, relationship building, being able to remember what people are saying, doing, feeling, wanting, and being able to, a year later, 2 years later, remember that and bring that into conversation. And figure out ways of helping those folks move the needle in their own business and their own process and helping them get access to the right deals for their own thesis. You know, the people who come from a mindset of abundance and from a mindset of giving, paired with proper relationship building and client management, I think are the people who are succeeding at everything in business, but particularly in this type of environment and in this industry. So my, you know, advice for early investors or people starting on their syndication route, which I'm actually helping and mentoring quite a number of them right now, how do you run your first syndicate? How do you help a founder get raised money from investors? Is think of the long-term relationship that you're building. Never optimize for short-term gains and an extra 1% carry on this opportunity. If that comes at a risk of, you know, burning a bridge, that would be a fantastic friendship, would be a fantastic business relationship later down the line. And you know, recently had a conversation with a founder we just invested in. He's on his fifth startup, and I respect him a lot. And I really respect what he's saying and the insight that he's providing. He said, Vlad, you know, right now my biggest goal for me is to get to know you better and build a better relationship with you as an investor, because I want to work with you. If I end up doing a sixth company, I want you to be there, right? And whole, like this frame of mind that comes from someone with so much experience, right? Like, you know, 40 years of being in the business is really inspiring for someone who hasn't spent, you know, 40 years, who's not even 40 years old yet. It's just all about people, all about relationship, hiring, you know, personal relationship, business relationship, all of that is why people trust you, why people want to do business with you, and why people want to dedicate time, energy, and effort to help you achieve your goals, because that's all you're dedicated to achieving theirs. Mm-hmm. It's broad, but I think it's, at the same time, it's very specific, because if you take this at heart, you're going to change the way you take calls, the way you take meetings, and the way you follow up with people.
That's powerful. Thank you for sharing that. In terms of information diet or content diet that you follow, what are the different sources that you consume on a daily basis? How selective are you with so much information overload? It's, you know, becoming more and more important in terms of just process and the discipline to keep your minds, you know, in terms of creating your own little bubble when it comes to that. So I'm always fascinated by that. Share some thoughts on that.
For sure. So I'll give two short answers to that. One of them, and unfortunately it's not the case as much nowadays, I would say the past year has been really terrible at it, which is reading. I used to read quite a lot, and I'm still trying to be up to speed with you know, my ongoing and ever-growing list of books that I want to read, primarily on changes of thinking, right? Understanding the history of the world, what changed, what's changing, economics, politics, sociology, that would make me a better thinker and analyzer of opportunities. Say the, you know, most recent, those is Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond. Really, really enjoyed that book, and how, you know, history was just you know, a sequence of very key decisions that were taken by few people, and then some geographical and technological advances by some and all by others. Very fascinating book. But on the day-to-day content diet, I'm a big podcast guy, not being on podcast as much as we're doing right now, but also listening to a lot of podcasts, primarily because I'm always walking. And it helps me, you know, be productive while I'm doing something else. I'm following four people right now in the podcast. One of them is Alex Hormozi on overall business advice. Patrick Bet-David also on business advice and building sustainable companies. Naval Ravikant from AngelList on thinking frameworks. And angel investing as well, but I see thinking frameworks primarily. And Gary Vaynerchuk on everything coming on marketing, media, social media. So those four are the ones that I'm alternating most on between their podcasts, because they have very specific niches on how to build great business, how to market them, which surprisingly, you know, for me is very important, because that's the work I'm doing with the founders. It's not about just becoming a better investor, but becoming a better business leader, so I can help my founders become better business leaders. Not just select the best business leaders out there.
Absolutely. I love it. I'm going to add two more to your podcast list. Is please. One by Samir Kaji. Maybe you've heard, it's a podcast called Venture Unlocked. Okay. So he interviews a lot of emerging fund managers or established ones. And there's a lot of great conversation on just, you know, just the nature of the industry. And of course, the other one is Ivy Podcast.
Of course.
You'll be listener number three after my mom and my wife.
I don't think that's the case. You would have been able to bring the quality of you that you were bringing more if that was the case.
Yeah. Vlad, I can't thank you enough for your time today. It was a very short and insightful conversation. You were very generous with the information you've shared. What I love doing with all the podcast guests is do a follow-up recording in about a year, where we revisit the conversation from the past and see if everything we've discussed still makes sense, still applies. And I'm definitely looking forward to doing that with you as well.
I would love to. I think, you know, this retrospective is very important. And right now I'm actually working on the second edition of the book, because I realized that some of the stuff that was published in the first edition may not necessarily hold as true nowadays as it did back then. And I'll say primarily a big bet that WeWork is going to be the dominating player in the co-working space. That was pre-pandemic, and the fact that in-person will be the default option for a lot of startups moving forward, that was very much off the rails and not accurate as a prediction. But we learned from our mistakes, and I would love to revisit this in a year and say, okay, Vlad, what insight you shared last year, that was very much not true. So let's fix it.
I love it. So definitely let's do that. Thanks so much,
awesome,
man.
Awesome, John. Thank you so much for the invitation. Really much appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.